Brain Done on the Ideas Network. And this hour of the program, we're going to learn all about the history, and it's a fascinating history of the Great Lakes and also the future of the Great Lakes. What ails us, what we can do to make sure that they are healthy and that the water stays here and isn't shipped off to some other place in the world or some other place in the country. Dan Egan is our guest. His book, The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, has just been published last week. And he's been doing a number of book events. There's one coming up at Schlitz Audubon, which you may want to attend. It's a perfect setting for a talk about the Great Lakes, and we'll tell you when that is, and we'll do that later this hour. Dan is he's a reporter, and his beat has been the Great Lakes, which is a great beat to have at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's twice been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's won many awards, Columbia University Award, Alfred DuPont Columbia University Award, many other awards for his science writing. He's a graduate of Columbia Journalism School and the University of Michigan. And if you've followed him in the Journal Sentinel, you know that he's done very important stories, including one just recently about restoration work in the Great Lakes and the huge cuts to the Great Lakes restoration, which is being considered by the, well, it's probably going to happen by the current administration. So we have a lot to talk about with him, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Dan at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you grew up close to the shores of Lake Michigan. It's in your blood, huh?
Yeah, it's in my blood. I wouldn't say the shores of Lake Michigan. It was actually the banks of the Fox River in Green Bay. And I was born in 1967. So my childhood spent goofing around on the banks of the Fox River was not really what I would call a pristine wilderness experience. as a matter of fact, I remember we used to get in trouble for going down by the riverbanks, not because our parents were afraid that we were going to drown, but because it was just so dirty. It was like playing at the dump.
Oh.
As a matter of fact, I remember we used to pick out little nuggets of sulfur. This is near the Deep Here Dam.
Uh-huh.
And we'd bring it home and light it, and it was like low-grade firework. It would ooze and smell sulfury, and I just thought it was nature's bounty, like, oh, the river is providing this to us. And it was a little bit later that I learned that's it precipitates out of the water as part of the pulp-making process. So The river was a foul place, but that wasn't my only experience with the lakes at that age. Both sets of my grandparents had summer homes up on the Door Peninsula, so just an hour north of Green Bay, you know, the water was still clean and fish-filled and swimmable. And so I spent a lot of my childhood summer weekends and long weekends and vacations up there, and that kind of stuck with me when I left the Midwest after college.
Mm-hmm. You start your book, and I love, you're a beautiful writer, but I loved imagining, and this was so darn long ago, Nicolay on this birch canoe going from one end of the Great Lakes to the other. What a journey that must have been in 1640?
I think it was a little bit later than that, 1670s. The dates are, I've got too many numbers in my head at the moment. But yeah, you know, I always used to wonder that too. How the heck did these guys, you know, explore the Great Lakes in a canoe?
I know.
And it just kind of boggles the mind. But, you know, they were following the shoreline. And it was a lot easier to paddle than to walk. So, but yeah, it is fascinating. What's really interesting too is there was no white people, no white person discovered Niagara Falls until I think deep into the 1700s. Don't quote me. I don't have my book in front of me. But Niagara Falls was just kind of this elusive place, because the way the voyagers got into the Great Lakes was they would go up the St. Lawrence River and then start cutting over into Quebec and what is now in Ontario, and then they'd come out in Lake Huron, and from there they went to Lake Superior and then Lake Michigan, and it was only much later that they came back east and south and encountered Niagara Falls.
Mm. And tell us how Nicolay was dressed. I loved your description of his outfit, because he really didn't think he was going to encounter Native Americans.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a famous, I think it's at the Wisconsin State Historical Society. There's a very well-known picture, painting, portrait done, I think it was in the early 1900s, So this may be one artist's imagining. I'm certain it is. But as legend has it, yeah, he got off his boat, and he was dressed in some kind of ornate robe. He thought that he had done the job that Columbus had started many years earlier, and by that I mean he thought it was quite possible that he'd found China.
Oh.
And so he gets off his canoe, and this painting he has guns a-blazing. He has two fire sticks, and he's shooting them into the air. And there is a statue up in Green Bay, about 20 miles north of downtown at Red Banks, commemorating that arrival.
So, never seen that. Yeah. Give us, and you talk about that he was probably pretty amazed when he saw this huge body of water, because there wasn't one in France, and there isn't one anywhere else, really. How large this is, the Great Lakes.
Yeah, you know, I mentioned this in the book. The lakes are like nothing any European had ever encountered, and I think they were grasping, you know, for words, but also I think psychologically to try to convey what they were experiencing. This is a little off subject, but it's analogous. As I understand it, the first white people to see the Colorado River at the bottom of the Grand Canyon had never seen a canyon that size. So when they looked down at the river flowing below, they sized it up and figured it was about 8 feet across. When, you know, it's more of like a half a mile.
Right.
And I think something similar was going on here. This was just like no other place on Earth, and it still is. Conveying that back to your bosses in the old world, I think, was probably...
And what would the state of the lakes have been at that time? Pristine?
Yeah, you know, one of the kind of the themes in my book is that, you know, for how big they are, so they're 94,000 square miles, which is equivalent to the United Kingdom.
Really? It's that big?
They are collectively, yeah, the five lakes. And, you know, that's really hard to kind of grasp. But big as they were in many ways as ecologically isolated as a pond in the North Woods. And that's because they didn't have a direct connection to the outside aquatic world. And that's because on the western side of the basin, maybe 17, 18 miles from where we're sitting, is the subcontinental divide, which is basically a continental divide, which separates the waters of the Mississippi River Basin from those of the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. And that means any rivers or streams on this side of the divide and raindrops flow into the Great Lakes. And the same thing for the other side of the divide, they all flow down into the Mississippi River Basin. So there weren't fish and things commingling. And that's on the west side. On the east side, first of all, you had the roaring, tumbling St. Lawrence River, which was just, you know, essentially impassable. And that got you from Montreal to Lake Ontario. So Lake Ontario was pretty isolated, not as much as the upper four Great Lakes, Huron, Michigan, Erie, and Superior. They, of course, were protected by Niagara Falls. Now, things could get out. Things could tumble over Niagara Falls. I don't know how or what may survive, but it's, you know, it could happen. But there were no fish were going to swim bypass Niagara mm-hmm. Falls. So the lakes were left, you know, the term biologists use is biologically naive. They were very young. They only they've only existed since the last glaciers melted 20,000 years ago. Hmm. And an obvious question then is, well, if they're just big puddles of glacial melt, where do the fish come from? Now, the answer is they're not just big puddles of glacial melt. You got to look at the lakes essentially as a slow motion river. Lake Superior and all the lakes are steadily drifting eastward, going over Niagara Falls and flowing out to the Atlantic Ocean. But the fish that did colonize this area colonize the lakes were the ones that lived at what they call the snout of the glaciers, where they were melting and creating rivers. These fish lived down there, and as the glaciers retreated, they followed them up, and the glaciers carved the basin. I mean, that's their big critical role here. And then they filled it up, but that water's long gone. Anyway, so what was assembled here in the Great Lakes was a relatively very few number of fish living in, you know, an ecological balance that was quickly shredded when whites arrived to, you know, settle and lay claim to their seemingly unlimited bounty.
Right. Let's move way ahead. We have a lot of territory to cover, but there's a part of the book where you're doing an interview with, I believe, the last fisherman in Washington Island, who talks about what he used to fish when he was a kid and the kind of fish and what fish are eating now, how there's been really an evolutionary thing going on with whitefish, I believe it is, right?
Yeah, well, not just whitefish. It's the bright spot of this story.
Right. Thought we would get to that first, Dan.
Good. So what's happened, and it's complicated, and I'm sure we'll probably touch on some of these things, but the lakes have been just turned upside down ecologically since we opened them to the rest of the aquatic world. This isolation that I was talking about was destroyed by the construction of some Chicago canals, culminating with the opening of the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal, and then with canals bypassing Niagara Falls, first the Erie Canal on the U.S. side of the border, and then the Welland Canal. And then the Welland Canal was steadily expanded, and then it eventually became part of the Seaway, which opened in 1959. The idea behind the Seaway was that we were going to turn Milwaukee and Duluth and Buffalo and Cleveland into these ports that were going to rival anything on the western coasts. And it was a good idea at the time, but it wasn't, I would argue, it wasn't entirely well executed. They built the system too small. I mean, it was in some ways obsolete before it opened. It's also closed 9 months of the year because of ice. So anyway, we didn't get as many ships as we wanted, but we got a lot of stuff that we didn't want, and that's invasive species. And so they've really rocked the ecosystem. And a lot of them came in the ballast water of ships sailing up the Seaway, but some of the most important ones swam in up the canals. Hmm. And that's what happened here. The sea lampreys came in and knocked out the lake trout, which were the wolf of the system, the king of the food chain. And with that mechanism, that control removed from the system, little fish exploded. And, you know, what do you know? Right behind the lamprey comes the alewives, which mm-hmm. are another East Coast invasive fish. And they just went to town in the lakes by the 1960s. They were biologists were estimating that they were accounting for 90% of the fish biomass, which
goodness.
Means for every 10 pounds of fish, you got 9 pounds of alewives, and they were prone to die. And so, yeah, that was the first wave of destruction. But what's since happened is the invasions kept coming, and we got zebra and quagga mussels. I'm sure many people are familiar with those. It's really hard to describe what zebra mussels have been squeezed aside. This is mostly a quagga mussel, closely related mussel phenomenon now. But you could basically, if you get beyond the sandy beach of Bradford, you could walk on a bed of quagga mussels from here to Muskegon, just
goodness.
Clustered, gnarled like black coral. And so that sucked a lot of the life out of the lakes. And it's basically a nutritional dead end because all the plankton that they're feeding on is getting sequestered in these shells. Well, here comes another invader, the round goby. It came from the same place as the mussels, the Caspian Sea Basin, and it came the same way in the ballast tanks of overseas freighters. And the round goby was and still is largely considered kind of a cockroach of a fish, much like alewives were back in the 1960s. But the magic, if you want to call it magic, about the gobies is that they eat mussels. And so things that can eat gobies are suddenly finding that this nutritional dead end has been unlocked. And that brings us up to your question about what's going on with some of the native fish. On Lake Huron, the alewives are gone, largely because of the mussels stripping so much energy or food out of the water column, and because the salmon that were introduced to eat the alewives, they knocked them out from the top, and then the mussels knocked out the alewives from the bottom. They got it from both directions. They're gone, and so are the salmon. And now here come the natives eating the gobies. So you have lake trout surging in Lake Huron and beginning to do so in Lake Michigan, as well as walleye. And then whitefish. Whitefish are eating both mussels and, this is remarkable, gobies. And it's remarkable because they are not a fish-eating fish. a piscivore.
Goodness.
They are doing, it's gobies or death, and they're choosing gobies. And so these commercial fishermen report finding these whitefish, because they don't have teeth, because they're not eating fish. They find them coming in their nets with their jaws just kind of torn open from getting their mouths around the meal that is a goby. So and it's really kind of exciting to see what's happening on Lake Huron. It's sad for the charter boat guys and the salmon fishermen who for generations have been leading advocates for lake health. But for sustainability, from a sustainability perspective, it's interesting because the food chain at the top, the food web, is starting to look more like its natural self than it has in a long, long time, and it's being done on the backs of the gobies. So while the bottom of the food chain is totally different, the top is seems to be kind of reassembling itself.
And what about these invasive species coming in because they attach to freighters? Have we taken care of that? Are the ships still carrying these invasive species? There aren't that many ships anymore either,
yeah,
are there?
There aren't a lot of ships, and so the primary pathway isn't they can cling to the hulls of these boats, but more importantly, they're in these ballast tanks, which are used to stabilize the big freighters that we see out on the lakes. You know, they don't always have full cargo loads or uniformly balanced cargo loads, so they take on water to even the ship. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when they take on water, it's not dead weight, literally. It carries anything that might be lurking in the port where it's picked up, and so we get these boats, you know, from any port you can imagine anywhere in the world, picking up anything you can imagine. Mm. And when they come here and discharge their ballast for cargo, these things can jump ship. Now, the shipping industry has done a lot. Since 2006, every ship coming into the system has been required to flush its ballast tanks with salt water in mid-ocean, the idea being that you will expel or kill whatever is lurking in those tanks with freshwater organisms lurking in those tanks with a blast of salt water. They've only found one new species in the Great Lakes. That was pretty recently, and I don't remember the name of it. It was late last year, I believe, or maybe, yeah, I think it was late last year. Other than that, they haven't found anything new since 2006, and that's really significant because up to then they were finding new things, new organisms. It peaked at a rate of once every 6 months, twice a year. So they're not finding anything new now, and that's great, and that's encouraging, and the shipping industry should be congratulated for doing that, but that doesn't mean that the door is shut. The science and the scientists doing that science say that, you know, the door remains open, and all it takes is one new quagga mussel type organism. I mean, nobody ever heard of a quagga mussel until they became the dominant player in the lake. Who knows what else is lurking out there that could once again totally rewire the way energy flows through the system. So has the problem been solved? No, it hasn't, but we've taken steps. And right now, this is important. The Environmental Protection Agency was sued and is finally being forced to treat this ballast water as an industrial pollutant, just like any other pollutant in the Clean Water Act. They haven't gone far enough, according to conservationists and according to judges, because they've been sued repeatedly and they've repeatedly lost. And so right now, the agency is drafting some new regulations. You know, they're already on their way to requiring ballast water treatment systems, kind of like water treatment systems at Jones Island, but mini. They're mandating that those be put on boats, but that's going to be a phased-in program that's going to last years and years. And we don't know where we're going regulatorily right now.
Right.
And so maybe this door stays cracked open for ever.
Well, you wrote a piece just fairly recently, March 4th, in the Journal Sentinel. Mayor's conservationists blast possible cuts to Great Lakes restoration work. Huge cuts to the restoration work.
Well, yeah.
How is that related to what we've been talking about, and how does it go beyond what we've talked about?
It is and it isn't. You know, the Great Lakes Restoration Program was conceived, I think George W. Bush kind of got the ball rolling on it, but President Obama was the one who initially funded it. And it was conceived as like an Everglades-style restoration program, or Chesapeake Bay, just a big ecosystem-scale cleanup fix-it program. And the lakes have suffered a lot, you know, beyond invasive species. I'm specifically talking about fertilizer overload, sewage overflows, industrial excrements. And a lot of this money is going to, you know, clean up those legacy problems. Hmm. But it's got to be said that the lakes, in terms of, you know, the traditional pollution, a lot's been done since the Clean Water Act. And this money was needed, and it's been doing great work. They're restoring wetlands. They're, you know, resuscitating habitat. They're cleaning up, we don't call them Superfund sites in the Great Lakes. They're areas of concern, but contaminated harbor and harbor sediments. And so, you know, it's a win-win. I mean, it's money well spent. But as you said, the mayors were upset that the budget that was leaked showed that they were going to cut the annual funding from $300 million. It was at one point more than $400 million when it first began in 2010. But they were talking about cutting it 97%. Well, today, if you can believe what you read in the New York Times, and I can believe it, they've eliminated the program entirely. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's got to go through Congress. And here's what's interesting, too. I mean, if you look at a map and think politically, and you look at the Great Lakes Basin, and you've got a lot of purple there. You've got Ohio, Michigan, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. I mean, these are areas that are battleground states, and they are populated by people who love the Great Lakes, whether they are Republicans or Democrats. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes.
Dan Egan, this guy knows the Great Lakes. Nobody I've ever met is our guest this hour. His latest book is The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. It's been getting terrific reviews, and it's very, very thorough. It goes back to where we started the show with Nicolay, taking the trip down the Great Lakes back in 1670-something or somewhere around there, something like that. I would imagine we, of course, live on the shores of Lake Michigan, and we're on the shores of Lake Michigan, pretty close to it here in our studios. So these are important bodies of water to all of us and to Canadians as well. And we are talking with Dan this hour and welcoming phone calls, too. Here's how you can reach our conversation. If you have been fishing in the Great Lakes, too, we'd be interested in how things have changed for you over the course of your time fishing. If you are concerned about the health of the Great Lakes, we'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is ideas@WPR.org. We're also on Facebook at The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we like to read your comments. And we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Dan is a reporter. He covers the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His book just released last week. He has twice been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, has won all kinds of awards for his reporting. And we wanted to let you know, too, this would be a great event to go to because the Audubon Center is on the shores of Lake Michigan. He will be there on Wednesday, March 22nd. He'll be speaking at 7 o'clock, and there's a hike at 6 o'clock. So what better way to spend the first days of spring than listening to Dan hiking Lake Michigan and talking about all of these topics. There go the phones. We got many of them. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Lots of calls for you, Dan. We start with Kurt in Green Bay. Hi, Kurt.
Hi. I've got a couple. This is something that's been weighing on my mind for a long time. So I have these two ideas for dealing with the exotic species. The first one is, if these ships could run heat lines from their boilers through the bilge and their ballast tanks, mm-hmm. they could, if you'll pardon the joke here, they could make it into a fine tasting soup. Okay, and so my thought is that this would be a fairly simple modification to run pipes from the boilers to heat that water up so that it turns into a soup, which then if they dump it, who cares?
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. You know, there's a lot of people looking at a lot of different ways to, and people say sterilize these ballast tanks, but that's not really a good word to use because we can't even sterilize a hospital room, let alone these tanks that mm-hmm. can hold some 6 million gallons of water. They are looking at UV light. They're looking at chemicals. They're looking at filtration. They might be looking at heat. I mean, that to me just intuitively sounds interesting. The thing that you're up against, though, is life itself and the durability of some of these critters that are in there. I mean, they can exist in many life stages, cysts that could withstand just about, you know, anything we could throw at them. But, yeah, that, I like the thought, and I like that you're thinking about it.
Yeah, thanks very much. Glad you were listening today. It was a perfect day to be listening. Before we go back to phone calls, I just want to find out if we're settled here now that the water that's in the Great Lakes is going to stay here, or will it be shipped off to China or Utah or some other place that needs water?
Well, in 2008, we finally passed, and I say we, I mean the Great Lakes states and the Canadian provinces have a parallel agreement, but the eight Great Lakes states passed the Great Lakes Compact, which essentially prohibits diversions of water outside of the basin, which I was speaking about early, this dividing line where water on one side flows into the lakes and on the other side it flows out of the lakes. That's been in existence since 2008, but it was crafted very specifically to allow certain communities access to that water, provided that they send their treated wastewater back. What they're essentially doing is engineering themselves into the basin. Mm. And as you know, and I'm sure many of your listeners, Waukesha is the first community to apply for this exemption, and it has received it, and it is moving ahead with plans to run pipes. I believe it's from Oak Creek, and supply some 8 million gallons a day to Waukesha, mm-hmm. and Waukesha will send it back down the Root River. It's not a done deal. It's being appealed by some groups. I know that the Great Lakes mayors are opposed to it, and so this will be a real test because you know, the first application here is really going to set some precedents. But it's also worth noting that the 2008 agreement was wonderful. Was a wonderful example of regionalism, of how we got together and put aside our differences, we being the Great Lakes states, and came up with a set of rules that we could all agree to. Mm-hmm. And then Congress ratified it, and President George Bush signed it, and so we have it. But that doesn't mean we have it forever, because what Congress gives, Congress can take away. So I would say that, you know, we've gone as far as we can in protecting the volume of water in the lakes today. But that doesn't mean we don't have to worry about it tomorrow or in the decades ahead. Hmm.
Tim in De Pere, hi.
Hi. Question for Dan. Just tracking along with, and it's a great subject, along with the Great Lakes, but, you know, you hear so much about the Asian carp coming up through the southwest of the state, and I'm just wondering, is there any recent developments that they're applying in order to stem that invasion coming up and possibly wreaking havoc on all of these lakes?
Okay, I have to confess something. I cover the Great Lakes, so I look at this from a very lake-centric perspective. But you're right, the fish are coming up the Mississippi River Basin and could be moving up into the Wisconsin River system. Now, there's a lot of dams and such that would prohibit their, you know, unfettered access inland. But the big pathway that people are worried about at the moment is the one up the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And that's where the fish are mustering at the moment, just 30-some miles from the shores of Lake Michigan. And most people, most Great Lakes advocates, and many politicians outside of Chicago believe the permanent solution is to fix the ship canal so the Chicago River flows into Lake Michigan as nature designed it instead of out of Lake Michigan. That's not going to happen anytime soon. An interim solution, a Band-Aid solution in place right now is an electrical barrier system that does have a history of shutdowns and leaking fish. It's not strong enough to repel really small fish, but they don't believe small fish are in the area. Mm. But beyond that, they're looking at modifying one of the locks on the canal, so it would become something like a decontamination chamber where you would be able, as a barge moves through, you could zap it with, I'm not sure how it functions, but you would basically create a sterile chamber or a disinfected chamber to prevent the fish from moving through. That plan was supposed to be released just a few weeks ago, but it's been held up by the administration or by the Army Corps of Engineers and not released, much to the consternation of people who are worried about what these fish could do to the lakes and inland lakes as well in Wisconsin. Mm.
Thank you, Tim, for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Jordan in Marengo. Hi.
Hey there. Yeah, I'm old enough to remember those alewife blooms in Sheboygan. I grew up about two blocks from the lake, and even that far inland, you couldn't breathe. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. And anyway, to the Lamprey Point, I live up near the Brunswiler River now, which flows into the Bad, into Lake Superior, and it is a repository for the lamprey, and when they occasionally hit the river with the lampricide, it's designed not to have too bad of an impact on the other species in the river, but it does knock down the crayfish and smaller fry, but it's astonishing to see thousands of dead lampreys lining the bottom of the river. It's like some kind of freaky horror movie kind of thing. And if it's interesting to people, go ahead and canoe the bottom of the Brule River from 13 out to the lake. You get to go through a lamprey dam, which is pretty interesting to see how serious you have to engineer this problem, really, to try to control it. But, yeah, the scenery's horrible. The Class 1 rapids are no fun at all. And the beach is just ugly. So don't, on second thought, nobody paddle the Brule. So that's what I have. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks, Jordan. Thanks for the call.
Well, the story of the lampreys and the lamprecide is really fascinating.
Yes, go ahead.
So when the lake trout got knocked out and the alewives exploded, the lake's managers knew that they couldn't do anything until they figured out the lamprey problem, because they needed a predator to eat the alewives. And so they assembled themselves up in far northern Michigan on the shores of Lake Huron, and they spent years trying to find a chemical that would be deadly to these lampreys, which are a very, very primitive creature. They haven't had like an evolutionary upgrade in over 300 some million years.
No kidding.
Yeah, no, they're like they say, swimming fossils. Yeah, they've and so this has left them with a pretty crude liver, which is kind of an Achilles tendon. It's funny to call a lamprey having an Achilles tendon, but anyway, they ended up hitting on a poison, and I think they named it this because it makes everybody feel better. They call it lampricide, and it is specific to lamprey, although it does have, as the caller said, some bad effects on some other organisms, but not to the extent that a less specific poison would. So, that was just a remarkable story, and we got so lucky, because if you stand on the shores of the lakes and you look out there and you think, oh, we've got untold millions of these things swimming, how are we going to poison the lake with any lakes with anything? Mm-hmm. But because they spawn in these specific rivers and streams, that was just kind of their weak spot. So once they found the poison, they knew where the lampreys were, and they've got them, under, and they're using other control methods as well, as the caller mentioned, a dam, and they're doing some other more high-tech things. But they've got them knocked down to a fraction of their peak population, which allowed the restoration of some type of predator into the lakes. And for many people, the natural choice would have been in the 1960s to bring in lake trout. But some guys over in Michigan had another idea, and that's how we became a salmon fishing destination. Mm. Brought in Pacific salmon to eat these Atlantic alewives in the middle of North America.
Which maybe wasn't a good idea?
Well, no, I think it was a good idea, but it has come with some costs. Now, I want to be clear that, they solved a problem, and then the salmon created a huge constituency for the lakes. I mean, the charter boat operators and the recreational fishermen and women are some of the people who care most passionately about the lakes, and they have, and they cared at times when fewer people did. The problem is these mussels. They're sucking the life out of the lake, and the alewives are taking a hit, and because of that, the salmon could be running out of things to eat. This has happened on Lake Huron. Mm. It appears to be happening on Lake Michigan, and so there's a tension now between, keeping the lake humming along as a salmon fishery, or beginning to manage it for native lake trout, which can survive on gobies, not alewives, and salmon, unfortunately, largely can't.
We need to talk before we go back to phone calls about fertilizer runoff, toxic algae, which has been horrendous in certain parts of the Great Lakes over the past few years. What's being done about that, and how big a problem has it been? Will it be?
It's a huge problem, and I'm beating a drum here, and people are probably getting tired of hearing about these mussels, but they are a factor in this. I'll talk specifically about Lake Erie and what happened there in the summer of 2014. I believe it was late July. They had an algae outbreak that was toxic, that was poisonous, mm-hmm. that literally, you know, made the water poison for 500,000 residents. Mm. And this isn't a toxin or a contaminant that you could boil out of the water. If you boiled it, you only concentrated it. Mm. And this is a problem driven by a number of things. It's driven by phosphorus running off of farmlands and some other places, but primarily farmlands into the lake. That's feeding the algae blooms. And in the past, when Lake Erie had algae blooms, it was a whole assemblage of algae. But because of these mussels, now when there's an algae bloom, it's typically a toxic form of blue-green algae. It's cyanobacteria, I think is what it's officially known as, called microcystin. And so these mussels, they don't have brains, but they're smart enough to spit out this microcystis when they suck it out of the water column. You can see it on YouTube. There's videos of these things in aquariums just sucking in everything, but when they get a piece of this microcystis, they spit it out. This microcystis creates this toxin called microcystin, and it's colorless and it's odorless, and it is a huge problem depending on the type of season that they're having over on Lake Erie. And these blooms are problems in inland lakes as well. And so what can we control? You know, we can't control huge big spring storms that send pulses of fertilizer into the lakes. And we can't at this point, and probably never will be able to, control mussels on an ecosystem scale. So we can control nutrients and we can control phosphorus. And we have a plan. And, you know, we had a plan back in the 1960s after the Cuyahoga River famously caught fire. And it should be noted what's important about that fire is it was the last time the Cuyahoga burned, because it burned all throughout the 20th century. Mm. For some reason, in 1969, people saw flames on the front page of their newspaper and they had enough. And we got the Clean Water Act. And that led to dramatic reductions in many pollutants, including phosphorus, going into the lake. And Lake Erie was specifically put on a phosphorus diet. They gave regulators put together a plan that said if we can reduce the phosphorus loading to this many, I forgot the numbers, but to this level, we can stop these bad algae outbreaks. And at this point, it wasn't just microcystis. It was just goop. Mm. It rendered the beaches unswimmable. Mm. And they knew the number that they had to hit, and they did some things that, you know, weren't really popular, like pulling out phosphate from, largely pulling it out from detergent.
Right,
and so some sacrifices were made, but the benefits were incredible. I have a little quick story, if you want.
No, go
okay.
ahead.
So this Lake Erie, you know, kind of hit its nadir with these algae blooms and this phosphorus problem in the 1970s, and it was put on its diet, and the recovery was remarkable. As I mentioned earlier, the lakes are like a river. They're always flowing, and so each lake has a residence time, which is basically how long it takes all the water in that lake to flow out. And Lake Erie's is remarkably short because it's a remarkably small Great Lake. It's like every 2.7 years. So you get a new lake, in a way, every 2.7 years. They fixed the problem. And but it was still a problem in the early 70s when Dr. Seuss wrote The Lorax. And he took a big crack at Lake Erie, where he's talking about a place where fish grow woefully weary, swimming in water that's so smeary or some such thing. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote, I hear things are just as bad up in Lake Erie. That was in the early 70s. In the mid-80s, a couple of Ohio State University graduate students wrote Dr. Seuss and said, you know, that's not fair anymore. And he wrote them back. I got a copy of this memo. He wrote them back and said, you know, due to great science and civic pride and, you know, the efforts of many people, you're correct. I should no longer be saying bad things about Lake Erie. And he pulled it. He pulled it from The Lorax. Problem is it might be more appropriate to put it back now.
Dan Egan is our guest this hour. His book is The Death and Life of the Great Lakes. He knows his subject. He is his beat is the Great Lakes. He is a reporter, award-winning reporter, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning finalist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our number is 800-486-8655. Email is ideas at WPR.org. We'll take more of your communications in a moment here on the Ideas Network. And we have many calls coming in for Dan. Let's go to Steve in Fitchburg next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, great show. Could you speak to the oil pipeline that I believe the age and the condition that it might be in that's laid through the Mackinac Straits? And as an aside, my folks lived in St. Joe Benton Harbor for 34 years, and my dad was part of... feeding little salmon fishies and letting them go into the St. Joe River and restocking them. It was a DNR, Michigan DNR and Sportsman's Club collaboration. And I'll listen off air.
Thanks. You've written about the pipeline, so.
Yeah. You know. Okay. So, in 1950, there was a Canadian company that laid the first pipeline from Western Canada to Superior, Wisconsin. And their idea was they needed to get this oil to Canada's refineries in Sarnia, which is northeast of Detroit, on the St. Clair River. So for the first 3 years, this pipeline terminated in Superior, and they put it on specially built fleet of boats, and they were putting crude oil on the lakes.
Oh, dear.
And, they did it without incident, except for one of the boats did explode in Sarnia when it was right after its cargo had been emptied. I think they were converting it over to carry something else for the season, and a spark lit and the boat blew up. But they knew at the time that this was not a sustainable practice, floating all that oil out there on that big lake of Superior. You know, there was a better way. So they decided to lay a pipeline, and they had two options. They could go south from Superior around the bottom of Lake Michigan. And when I say bottom, I don't mean the lake bottom. I mean Chicago, Gary, Indiana area, and then across lower Michigan to Sarnia. Or they could take a northern route through the UP and then along the bottom of Lakes Michigan and Huron. And when I say the bottoms of Lakes Michigan and Huron, I mean the bottom of the lake. They went that route. And so in 1953, they built two 20-inch pipes on the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac, which is really a very critical point in the Great Lakes because it's where Lake Michigan and Lake Huron meet. And not that long ago, I'm talking 6,000 or 7,000 years ago, Huron and Michigan were separate lakes, and they were connected by a river, and that river is at the bottom of the Straits of Mackinac, and it still, in a way, exists. As a matter of fact, there's tree stumps down there, from what I understand. They're still along the ancient riverbank, but anyway, that area is still, in essence, a river channel, except for it flows both ways, depending on weather, precipitation, barometric pressure. It can push water east or it can push it west. So it has some of the most ferocious currents in all the Great Lakes. And the volume going through it on any given day has been calculated to be like 10 times the equivalent of Niagara Falls. So you have these two pipes that are just lying there. They're not buried. They're buried up to a depth of 60 feet. And once the water gets deeper than 60 feet, they're allowed just to lay on the bottom. And they've been there now, if we could do the math, 64 years, 63 years. And the currents are a big concern. And the company running the pipelines, they do chronic inspections, and they're entirely comfortable with the pipes being there. And they're very, very confident that they're not going to break. But a lot of people don't share that confidence, and particularly some Michigan leaders. So they're looking at... how long these things should be able to operate. And there's two studies underway. One is, what would it cost if it broke? And the other study is, well, if we did shut it down, where would that oil flow? And this is relevant to your listeners are in Wisconsin here. The only, I wouldn't say the only, but a logical route would be through Wisconsin. Because 1953, they laid that northern route, and then in the late 1960s, they laid a new route through Wisconsin. And today we have running down that route the capability to carry more than 2.5 million barrels a day, and that's a lot of oil. Coming into Superior, if you add in this pipeline underneath the Straits of Mackinac and the lines running through Wisconsin, it's approaching 3 million barrels per day, and that's roughly the equivalent of the volume of the Milwaukee River in late August up at Esterbrook Park.
Mm. And what would happen if something happened to those pipes in Mackinac?
Oil would get out, and who knows how much. Enbridge operates the pipes, and they have valves on both sides. I'm talking about the Straits specifically here, and they say they could shut it off and contain it, and you know there'd still be thousands of gallons that would be set free. And a lot of people are dubious about Enbridge as a company because that is the company that had the spill into a tributary of the Kalamazoo River back in 2010 when more than a million gallons got loose and it was a $1.2 billion cleanup. So I think everybody agrees that Enbridge has become a safer company since that spill. But these pipes in Mackinac haven't gotten any younger. And, and Enbridge says that they can. There's no reason they can't operate indefinitely. And other people say, hey, anything that humans build, you know, whether it's a pipe or a bowling ball, it's going to break at some point. Right. And the big question in Michigan is, are we going to stop these lines before they break or after they break? And that's kind of an interesting binary way to look at it.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve, very much for bringing us into that area of discussion. Scott in Green Bay, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Scott.
I was listening earlier and heard you talking about the introduction of salmon and how they didn't put lake trout back in right away. And to my understanding, they put the salmon in because they just grow that much faster, and they put them in to become a more instant answer to the alewife problem.
Yes, go ahead.
And from there, you know, it became a salmon industry as far as the fishing goes, and that's really what we want as far as a fishing industry, at least from the charter boat point of view.
You run a charter boat, right, Scott?
Yes, okay. Yes, I do. I have a number of them.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're looking at that, you know, Lake Huron, you know, had a problem when the salmon were eating too many of the alewives, and I just kind of got to step in and almost correct you there. It's the lake trout that have become the problem on Lake Huron and also are becoming the problem on Lake Michigan. There's really not room in these lakes for two top predators. So you have to decide which one is going to be the top predator. And Lake Michigan's been trying to, you know, juggle two top predators being the king salmon and the lake trout. And the king salmon's the one that's getting the bad press for eating all the fish, when really they're hardly planting any salmon at all compared to what the feds are putting in to Lake Michigan as far as lake trout. Every year they're dumping 3.8 million lake trout into Lake Michigan every year. You know, they're looking at a fish that's reproducing on its own now, and that can live, you know, 30 to 40 years, where a salmon's only living 4 years.
Right.
Dan.
Yeah, no, he makes good points. I mean, the salmon were a logical control mechanism back in 1966 when they began the planting program to get control of the alewives, which, you know, were a huge problem. There is tension between salmon advocates and lake trout advocates. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the salmon fishermen have really been the stewards of the lake for so long, and you can see why they are concerned that efforts to restore lake trout are coming at the expense of the salmon, which really drive the recreational fishing industry. But I don't think it's necessarily a matter of you know, who's pulling what lever and how many fish we're putting in. As you mentioned, there's natural reproduction, both of salmon to a less, I mean, most of the salmon reproduction, as I understand it, is coming from not this side of the lake. And there's natural reproduction of lake trout. And I'm sure there is, you know, some crossover in their diet. But lake trout, I mean, I spend 3 hours a week with a fisheries biologist from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, teaching a class with him, and he's a lake trout guy, and he, you know, as he explains it, lake trout are really thriving on gobies, and salmon aren't. What happened on Lake Huron, you know, it's been a big question. Did they put in too many salmon, or did nature just take over? Mm. And I think that may be what happens here. I mean, hopefully a balance can be struck, but maybe we're not as in control of the lakes as we were back in the 60s. Mm.
Dan, thank you so much. What an incredible hour. I learned so much. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Dan Egan, the book is The Death and Life of the Great Lakes, and it's been receiving really wonderful, wonderful reviews compared to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring by one person who reviewed it. He is a two-time Pulitzer Prize finalist. He covers as his beat the Great Lakes, and he certainly knows his beat. We thank him for being with us. Just a reminder, this sounds like a really neat event. It's on March 22nd. Dan will be at a Schlitz Audubon event, and it's at 7 o'clock. There will be a hike because the Audubon Center is along Lake Michigan, so there will be a hike, and then Dan will talk about his book. That's next week, Wednesday, March 22nd at 6 p.m. Thanks to Colleen Duvall for producing this hour, and to Colleen as well for on-air production here in Milwaukee. Have a wonderful St. Patrick's Day tomorrow. Fun to celebrate the first hour of our show today, and this hour was very informative. We're with you again for All Things Political Monday at 1:00.